Welcome to Western Voices. I'm John Young of European Americans United. On today's Western Voices podcast, I'll be covering the topic of peak oil. Because the topic is quite involved, I'm breaking it down into two broadcasts. Today, I'll be explaining what peak oil is, the fact that it is an issue of real concern, existing energy sources and technology that could mitigate the effects, and what experts are predicting for society as a result. If you've been paying attention to our news website, wvwnews.net, you've seen a number of articles over the months about a phenomenon known as peak oil. I cannot claim specific expertise in the oil business, but most of the matter boils down to common sense that anyone can understand. The gist, almost entirely undisputed, is that crude oil is a finite resource that becomes progressively more difficult to remove from the ground as its supply wanes. As the supply decreases, it becomes increasingly expensive. This is as close to factual as you can get. The only question in dispute is not whether, but when it will happen. The GAO, Government Accountability Office, issued a report in February 2007 that predicted it would occur sometime between right now and 33 years from now. By its very nature, peak oil is the sort of thing that will only be recognized after it has already happened, so an accurate prediction is difficult. What I can tell you is that recently the International Energy Agency predicted that demand would exceed supply this summer, and that China imported 23% more oil last month than they did a year ago. What I can also tell you is that, according to the GAO, quote, there is no coordinated federal strategy for reducing uncertainty about the peak's timing or mitigating its consequences, end quote. So the first thing I want you to take away from today's broadcast is that peak oil is real. While the details are a bit sketchy, due to a number of confounding factors, peak oil is an absolute fact and not something that can just be wished away by putting our collective heads in the sand. Oil production has already peaked for all countries outside of Southwest Asia. The United States is the world's third largest oil-producing region, and our oil production peaked in 1970 and has been declining ever since. But before we can effectively analyze the likely results of the peak oil phenomenon and what we should be doing about it individually and as a group, we must first look at the way Americans live. Commerce of various sorts is the economic engine of the nation. Whether you love cities or hate cities, they are an essential lubricant for commerce in that they concentrate huge numbers of interrelated enterprises in close proximity in order to gain efficiencies. The cost of residential property, either for purchase or rental, is largely a function of accessibility to jobs in the cities, as cities are the areas with the greatest levels of employment. So it should be no surprise that in most suburbs of Boston, a small single-family home costs between $300,000 and $400,000, but you can buy 100 acres in rural Kentucky for less than $50,000. A second factor that influences the cost of housing is the phenomenon of white flight. The so-called inner-city areas that are populated largely by minorities, almost without exception, manifest high crime, poor living conditions, and abominably performing schools. There are reasons for this that we won't go into for now. Suffice it to say that white families move from such areas into areas that have lower crime, better living conditions, and better schools. As a result, they bid up the price of housing in such areas, but not so much that it is more expensive than comparable homes in good neighborhoods in the city. Thus, within cities themselves, most housing falls into one of two extremes. Ghetto-like conditions are so expensive only the most wealthy can afford it. The suburbs closest to the city are the most expensive, and the further away you go, the more affordable they become. This allows employers in the cities to pay wages that would support someone living in a suburb, though not the city proper, which allows the business to be more profitable and efficient, while allowing employees a higher quality of life. The commodity that enables employers to gain this efficiency, while also allowing employees to earn a city wage while living in a less expensive place, is oil. Whether used for public transportation or private vehicles, plentiful petroleum at cheap prices is the commodity that allows this to happen. It is at the root of how we, as Americans, live and work. With this in mind, let us return to peak oil. The term used in the GAO's report, consequences, has a rather dire sound, and it ought to. The economic, social, and political implications of a future decline in oil availability are profound. Already, rising gas prices have led to reduced consumer spending for 40% of us, with retail outlets like Walmart feeling the effects. Economic growth has slowed, and retail sales have slumped across the board as a direct result of increased fuel prices. Just how disruptive peak oil is likely to be depends on a lot of factors. For example, the rapidity of the development of alternative fuels, whether unaudited OPEC nations are telling the truth about their remaining reserves, and so forth. Yet, even the most optimistic view of alternative energy technology says that it will replace only 34% of our projected oil needs by 2030. This is nowhere near enough, so we can look forward to big economic problems. As the GAO report summarized, quote, "Ultimately, however, the consequences of a peak and permanent decline in oil production could be even more prolonged and severe than those of past oil supply shocks. Because the decline would be neither temporary nor reversible, the effects would continue until alternative transportation technologies to displace oil became available in sufficient quantities at comparable costs." End quote. Clearly, even if our government has no coordinated plan, we as individuals, families, and a community need to devote some thought to what we need to do in order to be prepared. Proper preparation requires at least some thought to what we'll be facing. So forewarned is forearmed, especially considering that some experts predict peak oil to be no more than 4 years away. There are a number of facts pertaining to energy production and use in the United States that are crucial to a complete understanding of the ultimate impact of a peak in oil production. The alternative fuels vaunted by many of us as the savior of civilization simply don't have the capacity to replace our current petroleum usage. For example, right now we use 30% of our corn crop to give us 10% ethanol in gasoline. In order to move that 10% up to 30%, we would have to use all of our corn production. In order to move it to 100%, we would have to triple our acreage in production. And currently high yields of corn depend on huge inputs of cheap energy in the form of fertilizers, insecticides, and herbicides that will become increasingly expensive. And as the Dust Bowl days so painfully illustrated, you can't put the earth under that much stress agriculturally for prolonged periods of time. Not only that, ethanol as an alternative fuel is entirely unworkable, because it actually takes 71% more energy in the form of fossil fuels to make ethanol than the ethanol contains. So the ethanol blended with gasoline is essentially a welfare program for corn farmers to garner the Midwest farm vote. Of course, we also use diesel on the roads, and in the form of heating oil to heat our homes. But biodiesel and other forms of vegetable oil could only replace 10% of our vehicle diesel supply at most. In addition, comprehensive studies of the potential for large-scale biofuels production conclude that not only is there not enough agriculture on Earth to supply our biodiesel needs, but even attempting to supply a substantial fraction of our energy needs with biodiesel would be inadvisable and disastrous. None of this counts the enormous amount of fossil fuel that goes into producing electricity, either. So the GAO report is correct. When ethanol, biodiesel, wind and solar power are combined, they will only replace 34% of our energy needs by 2030, and that figure depends on some very optimistic assumptions. Since peak oil could hit any day now, that means in all likelihood, we will be facing an energy deficit, accompanied by a prolonged and severe depression. So far, this analysis is pretty much on board with the standard predictions made by peak oil prognosticators. But it is also from here on out that our analysis will diverge. At various times in the past 100 years or so, there have been human beings who desire a return to simpler times. They seem to think all of the problems of the modern age would be solved if we could all just move back to the one-room schoolhouse illuminated by a whale oil lamp. In a sense, they see the collapse of our governments and social systems as something of a cleansing flood that will wipe out the corruption and give us a fresh start. This is why, if you read some of the websites and forums dedicated to the peak oil phenomenon, you will read an undercurrent of folks actually hoping for a widespread die-off of human populations. There have been many causes cited for an impending collapse of civilization, and peak oil is just the most recent. I hate to disappoint you, but don't hold your breath. Peak oil will certainly happen, and there will certainly be some human misery associated with it, but it is highly unlikely that it will serve to wipe the slate. It certainly won't bring down our government, and it won't automatically dislodge the apostles of epic evil from their seats of power. I'll talk more about that momentarily, but first I'd like to give you some mainstream predictions, even though I believe they will be partially mitigated. Many prognosticators believe that the widespread economic depression, an eventuality that virtually no one disputes, will necessitate a dramatic decrease in sustainable human populations. As Jay Hansen says, quote, "The sudden and surprising end of the fossil fuel age will stun everyone and kill billions," end quote. Some physicists have stated that the implications of peak oil have been recognized for some time, since the 1970s, and necessitated voluntary reductions in populations. This need has not been addressed, though, due to political correctness. In plain English, this means an awful lot of people are going to die, and a large number of these will be in places that are currently centers of wealth and power. The United States, rather than importing unassimilable aliens so that our elites can have gardeners at low prices, actually needs to reduce its population by one-third in order to avert a humanitarian disaster. To explain this, we need to take a look at the link between complexity of societies and the amount of energy they require to sustain that complexity. Look at the typical greater metropolitan area in the United States. Take Boston, for example. It is a city of about 600,000 people whose population literally doubles every day when the workday begins, and then goes back down at night. There is simply not enough housing for folks to live near where their jobs are. And what housing there is too expensive for most folks to afford. So they take subways, commuter rails, cars, and buses. Our entire economy is built around this sort of centralized model, in which the use of automobiles or some form of energy-consuming public transport is a practical necessity for most people. The automobile is a necessity for most people in order to get to work, in order to earn a living. Businesses can't afford to pay wages high enough for workers to be able to live near their jobs. The commuting infrastructure makes it possible for people to purchase less expensive housing, which enables a higher quality of life on a lower wage. Gas at $10 a gallon would change that dramatically. It would make it impossible for people to be able to afford to go to work at a time when a recession or depression is in progress and employers won't be able to pay higher wages. Meanwhile, this centralized model has gobbled up all of the farmland anywhere near our major population centers, meaning that all food has to be trucked in from hundreds and often thousands of miles away. Most food is raised on an industrial scale, using massive petroleum-sucking equipment, along with fertilizers and pesticides that require petroleum for their production. This is especially true of the core grain crops that supply the bottom of the food pyramid and serve as the primary base for animal feed. This problem will be exacerbated as an ever-increasing proportion of food materials are used to make ethanol and biodiesel. To make matters even worse, the current level of production of corn, for example, of 130 bushels per acre, is only possible through the use of mechanization, fertilizers, and pesticides. With these removed, productivity would drop to somewhere between 16 and 30 bushels an acre, depending upon the specific interplanting methods used. So an increase in the price of petroleum would be reflected in spiraling food prices for captive urban populations that often don't even have a square foot of earth available to grow their own food. Most folks who live in suburbs these days haven't the foggiest notion of how to provide their own food. The magic of electricity is what makes these centralized areas run. Power plants run on all manner of fossil fuels, mainly coal. But even though the supply of coal is relatively plentiful compared to petroleum, the rising cost of petroleum will substantially increase the demand for coal and natural gas as alternatives, making these more expensive as well. So you can expect electric bills to first double, then triple. Because electricity is used for a huge proportion of the heating and cooling in the totally environmentally controlled skyscrapers in which so many people live and work, these folks will be a captive population, forced to absorb those costs in order to avoid freezing. Even people who use oil or natural gas for heat will have to pay much larger electric bills because oil and natural gas furnaces require electricity to run pumps and blowers. The average family will have no choice but to absorb gigantic increases in the cost of necessities at a time when employers will be struggling for survival themselves. As a result, our society that has previously been able to turn the surplus production enabled by cheap energy into social safety nets won't have those surpluses or the safety nets. And all of this comes from the optimistic assumption that all of these energy resources will actually be available for some price, however high. A number of experts are nowhere near that optimistic and are predicting permanent blackouts of the electricity generating networks. Keep in mind that electricity is the basis of large-scale industrial civilization, and without it, industrial civilization at its current scale cannot exist. In the wake of these blackouts, that some experts predict to start sometime around 2012, some of these same experts predict that people will start dying in droves. The most dangerous places to be will predictably be near large cities. As Dr. Richard Duncan points out, quote, "Where will the die-off occur? Everywhere. But large cities, of course, will be the most dangerous places to reside when the electric grids die. There you have millions of people densely packed in high-rise buildings, surrounded by acres and acres of blacktop and concrete. No electricity, no work, and no food. Thus, the urban areas will rapidly depopulate when the electric grids die. In fact, we have already mapped out the danger zones. Specifically, the big cities stand out brightly as yellow-orange dots on NASA's satellite mosaics of the Earth at night. These planetary lights blare out, beware, warning, and danger. The likes of Los Angeles and New York, London and Paris, Bombay and Hong Kong are all unsustainable hotspots." End quote. If we, in the United States, were to maintain our population at about 200 million, the most dangerous aspects of peak oil would be averted. But we're full to overflowing as it is, and it's unlikely that situation will change in time. So the predictions of experts and government investigators range from a severe and prolonged economic depression on one end to the deaths of billions and chaotic killing zones on the other. Even though I believe some of these more severe effects will be partially mitigated, for reasons I'll explain soon, It should be clear to even the most dense of human beings that the energy crisis we will be facing in the near future will be serious, and the result, at the least, in a depression that will make the Great Depression look like a picnic with no surpluses available to help those who can't make it on their own. But now, let's take a look at the more positive and mitigating information that peak oil investigators often miss. Since most renewable and free energy sources never make it into industry statistics, energy analysts overestimate the importance of fossil fuels in the world's energy supply. Right now, for convenience, most of us use electric clothes dryers that are powered by petroleum-powered electric utilities. But many of us can remember when our families used very sophisticated renewable energy sources for this task: the clothesline and the drying rack. I'm not joking with you. Roughly 6% of the typical household's electric bill goes into the clothes dryer. Many people, though, still use a clothesline, and many more will do so in the future. One thing to keep in mind is that energy analysts don't include this energy in their statistics because it is inaccessible to markets and you can't be charged for it. They are just too locked in to seeing man in solely economic terms. There are a million other sources of energy of this sort that everyone seems to miss. For example, many homes are built so they take advantage of sun in the winter as a form of passive heating, and have deciduous trees on the south-facing side to provide natural cooling in summer. In addition, the sun provides us with abundant light for many hours every day, and just a few simple changes in the layout of commercial buildings would drop the need for internal illumination during the day dramatically. Likewise, energy industry figures have no way of accounting for the untold numbers of folks like myself who already do a lot of their home heating with wood. If you use an electric fan to circulate the heat generated by the wood stove, there are fans available right now that require no external source of power beyond that of the heat generated by the stove. Likewise, the self-generated electricity that already exists in many homes, camps, and businesses through the use of solar, wind, or even hydroelectric power never gets counted. Most folks think of geothermal energy as being associated with geysers. Rather, it is around us everywhere, as the Earth stays at a constant temperature once you go down more than a few feet. Technology already exists and is widely deployed across the country that provides most or all of a home's heating and cooling needs through direct thermal exchange with the Earth. One might suspect that such systems are ruinously expensive, but Environmental Protection Agency studies show that geothermal exchange systems actually have the lowest life cycle costs of any currently available heating, cooling technology. Even without massive investments, we already use geothermal energy to keep pipes from freezing in the winter and keep our basements cool in the summer. Again, the amount of energy already being used this way escapes accountants. Speaking of geothermal energy, there is a type of engine called a Stirling cycle engine that derives power from temperature differential, no matter what the source of that differential may be. Such an engine could not only exploit the temperature gradient between the Earth and ambient air temperature to generate power and electricity, it could also be used, according to a study done by Los Alamos Labs, to generate nearly limitless energy from the temperature differential between molten rock and ocean water. Stirling engines are also much more efficient than photovoltaic cells, and a company called Stirling Energy Systems signed a deal with California Edison in 2005 to build a 4,500-acre solar generating station that will produce more power than all other U.S. solar energy projects combined. I mention this as just an example of the sorts of energy technologies that aren't even on the radar screen of the Government Accountability Office or energy analysts, and that therefore aren't taken into account for their analysis. While substantial gains in the gas mileage of cars are unlikely in the near future, telecommuting is on the rise. It turns out that telecommuting provides benefits to both employees and employers, increases productivity, and generates huge savings for the companies in real estate costs. In an AT&T case study for one of their facilities in New Jersey, they saved $30 million in facilities costs and gained $150 million in increased productivity. This is another trend that isn't being taken into account for predicting the impact of peak oil. As the cost of commuting rises, and therefore the cost of real estate where most companies are located becomes more expensive and desirable, you can expect telecommuting to increase as a win-win for employers and employees. This will offset some of the demand for energy for transportation. Finally, the concept that fertilizer is made from oil, a concept repeated uncritically by numerous analysts, is false. The macronutrients required by plants, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, don't even exist in useful quantities in crude oil. Crude oil is composed predominantly of hydrocarbons, which compounds by definition are formed from carbon and hydrogen. Petroleum is most certainly used in the manufacture of fertilizers, ammonia in particular, but the natural foods movement that relies strictly on non-petroleum fertilizers is gaining a lot of steam. There are currently 3.7 million acres of land under organic management in the United States, and the organic production of food has been enjoying consistent annual growth rates exceeding 17%. In other words, while the effect of peak oil on the food supply will be substantial, the organic food movement is well underway toward developing sustainable farming methods that will cushion the blow. All of these factors will serve to mitigate what would otherwise be a worldwide die-off of billions of people, and leave us instead with a situation where we move from an era of superabundance to an era of just above subsistence, at least for a time. It is impossible to know just how much organic farming, telecommuting, alternative energy, and other factors will cushion the fall from peak oil. Will it be enough to make our current population of 300 million sustainable? I wish I could tell you, but I can't. Nobody really can. What I can definitely say, and I'll explore this a bit more later, is that the importation of even one more human being into our territory is foolhardy at best, and that we should be working hard to not only shut down immigration entirely, but to encourage emigration. We'll go into policy recommendations in the next broadcast, but before we leave this topic, we need to acknowledge and understand the largest problem that will be brought about by a major economic depression in the United States. Nobody is mentioning this problem because even considering the possibilities goes beyond mere political incorrectness into the realm of sheer terror. The United States has become a morass of ethnicities, coexisting with a sort of uneasy peace and tolerance. From the perspective of European Americans, this peace may look to be very stable. After all, you don't encounter on a daily basis the sort of rhetoric that blames all of your problems on some other group. Using a bit of personality projection, you sort of figure that because you don't hate any other groups don't hate you. You're wrong. They do. Now, I am certainly not talking about every member of every non-European ethnicity in the country. Most definitely, there are plenty of folks of all types who don't hate us. But the rhetoric to which they are exposed day in and day out, year after year and decade after decade, teaches them to hate us. For the past half century, the potential violence against European Americans that would be a natural outgrowth of such philosophy has largely been reduced by liberal applications of welfare programs, affirmative action, midnight basketball, and a plethora of housing, education, and employment preferences, backed up by monolithic mantras from all corners denying even the existence of race. Nevertheless, as I said, this truce is uneasy. The unfortunate fact is that right now, people of European ancestry are being specifically targeted by other racial groups for crimes of violence, and they are being targeted in large numbers. According to the New Century Foundation's Color of Crime report from 2005, European Americans are the victims of more than 654,000 violent interracial crimes every year, or nearly 1,800 every day. Since the Civil Rights Act was passed, more of our people have been killed by members of other ethnic groups than died in the Vietnam War. If you have ever wondered why our media doesn't report violent interracial attacks against our people, now you know why. General knowledge of this situation would break the uneasy truce by creating a violent conflict that went in both directions rather than just one way. It would take the multicultural dream world championed by the great masters of the lie and make it fall into tiny pieces. The phenomenon of violent racial attacks against our people is so pervasive that it would virtually be the only story in the news. The reason I bring this up is that a widespread and long-lasting economic depression will, by its very nature, expose the United States population to something virtually unknown for decades: resource scarcity. Resource scarcity is the single largest cause of ethnic conflict. Emmy Arobi wrote for the Conflict Resolution Information Source, quote, "In multi-ethnic societies, ethnic communities violently compete for property, rights, jobs, education, language, social amenities, and good health care facilities. It follows that multi-ethnic countries are likely to experience distributional conflicts." End quote. In fact, in study after study of both modern and historical inter-ethnic conflicts covering locales as diverse as India and Africa, resource scarcity is cited repeatedly is the primary cause. Resource scarcity is a problem when it prevents people from meeting their basic human needs, and when government is unable to step in even-handedly to address any deficits. As you well know, our government is far from even-handed. Basic human needs in this context go beyond food, water, shelter, and clothing, to include identity, security, recognition, participation, and autonomy. When such needs go unmet, or even worse, are met differently for different groups, ethnic conflict will erupt. Richard Fawcett described the situation you can expect. Quote, "Cultures are sets of rules. The more cultural borders containing different sets of rules there are in the same geographically bounded space, the more tension there is along them. And so diversity itself, the existence of many different group identities sharing the same space and competing for the same limited number of available niches, is the prerequisite for social conflict at close quarters." End quote. What this means in plain language is that, in the next depression brought about by peak oil, ethnic conflict is almost inevitable. In the next Western Voices, we'll explore the policies our government should be adopting, what European American advocacy organizations should be doing, and what individuals and families should be doing. We'll also explore the unique and unprecedented opportunities that peak oil will create, and how we can seize those opportunities to lay the path for a bright future for our people. This has been John Young with European Americans United. Thank you for joining me again today.